case of Rush versus the University of Virginia Health System et al. Who will be arguing for the appellant?
Judge, my name is Brad Young. I'll be arguing for Mr. Rush.
All right. And who will be arguing for the appellee?
This is Adam Katz, Your Honor. I'll be arguing for the appellee.
Excellent. All right. We're ready to proceed when you are. Mr. Young, do you wish to reserve any time?
Yes, sir. I do plan to reserve a few minutes.
Something around
do I need three? Do I need to specify that, Judge?
Well, I just want to, you don't have to, but I want to be able to,
I'd like to help. Yes, sir. I'm sorry. This is my first time telephonically. 5 minutes, please.
All right. Very well. And that way I can let you know when you're at the 5 minute mark and then you
yes,
can
sir.
Use it or not, reserve it or not at that time. All right. We're ready, Mr. Young. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Brad Young. I represent James Rush, who is the appellant here. In this case, we seek the benefit of Virginia Code Section 65.2-105 for him. At the outset, we think there are some important points to keep in mind as we discuss this case. We often speak of a case's procedural posture. Here, it's important, significant to look at this case's the issue here, the legislative judicial posture of the issue here. There's a long-standing presumption in Virginia workers' compensation law that an unexplained death by accident at the place of work is work-related. In 1991, the Supreme Court declined to extend that presumption to a non-death case, such as the one here. That was the Pinkerton's case. Significantly, the court spoke of the claimant in Pinkerton's in this way, quote, she was neurologically disabled and unable to recall the details of the accident. That's Mr. Rush's exact position here. In the Pinkerton's case, the Supreme Court said, we leave it up to the legislature to act in the field of a presumption. And so in 2011, the General Assembly acted, and they passed the statute at issue here. And
Mr. Young, this is Judge Petty. Setting aside for a moment the issue of whether the claimant was physically and mentally able to testify, the statute also requires that the factual circumstances are of sufficient strength that the only rational inference to be drawn is that the accident arose out of the employment and in the course of. We have no idea how this accident occurred, so how are the facts of sufficient strength to conclude that it arose out of employment?
Actually, Judge, the statute at issue here is different. In 2011, when this happened, the statute said where there is unrebutted prima facie evidence that indicates that the injury was work-related. You quoted from the statute after the General Assembly amended it. The statute at issue here, the law in effect here is as I just quoted it. But I can't address the issue you just raised.
You're correct. I apologize. I did look at the long statute.
Should I address that first, Judge?
Go ahead with your argument. Yeah.
Okay. Going back to, as I mentioned, in 2011, the General Assembly passed the statute at issue here. It's part of the Workers' Compensation Act, which is a remedial statute for the benefit of employees, and the statute is entitled to a liberal construction to achieve its aims. We often voice those words, but they still have significant meaning. In parallel, you have the Shaw case, this court's decision in Shaw, which we noted at pages 8 and 9 of our opening brief, that the court won't construe legislative action, quote, in a manner that would ascribe to the General Assembly a futile gesture. Now, turning to the two prongs here that Mr. Rush has to satisfy, the first one is the mentally unable to testify. commend to the court its decision in Jones against Commonwealth, which we cited at pages 6 and 7 of our brief, opening brief. Significantly, the employer here did not discuss Jones whatsoever in its brief. Jones shows that there's nothing remarkable about the proposition that 65.2105 applies here. It's undisputed here that Mr. Rush had a diagnosis of amnesia. That's in the medical records, no contrary evidence. He suffered a grievous injury to his brain. Mr. Rush literally was mentally unable to testify about his accident. Now, the commission adopted the employer's strict view that mentally unable to testify applied to where, that is, he was mentally unable to testify at the hearing, therefore he lost, because he was mentally able, for example, to come into the hearing and say, well, yeah, I had this for breakfast this morning. That was the test that they used. Well, are you able to testify at the hearing? Yes, I am. Okay, then you lose. Jones supports the liberal view that we espouse here, which is the statute, surely it can say mentally unable to testify at the hearing, but nothing forecloses that it also means mentally unable to testify about something. And in this case, Mr. Rush can't testify about the day of the accident. He was there, he was in the accident, but his testimony is unavailable because of his amnesia.
Judge Petty again, now that I've got the right statute up on the screen, the language is a little different. It talks about unrebutted prima facie evidence that the injury arose out of the employment. And that's where I'm having a little difficulty, because it doesn't seem that there's any evidence to suggest exactly how this accident happened. Can you help me with that?
Judge, yes, sir. Judge, in our opening brief, we talked about multiple aspects of Mr. Rush's workplace that enhanced the danger of a fall to him. He wore headgear, he wore a mask, he wore things around his neck, he wore shoe covers. He walked around on waxed floors. Now, the employer, nevertheless, would say, well, he could have still fallen in several ways. This court's in Liberty Mutual versus Herndon shows that that's an irrelevant consideration. The key pages I'm talking about in Herndon are 59 Virginia Appeals at 559, 62.
But Herndon did not do away with, nor could it, the concept of dangers that are common to the neighborhood.
That is correct.
And wax floors would be a danger that's common to the neighborhood.
Well, sir, if our position is that you envision someone and you say, well, here, we want you to put on this mask, we want you to put this stuff on around your neck, we want you to put these shoe covers on, we want you to walk around all day on slippery wax floors, that's not something everybody encounters every day. That's a unique danger of the workplace.
This is Judge Huff. There's no evidence that the floors, although waxed, were slippery, is there? I mean, I would expect the hospital used non-skid wax.
Judge, Mr. Rush's testimony at the hearing, which was not contradicted, was that the floors were always slippery. That's unrebutted testimony in the record. Turning again in Herndon, no one saw the claimant fall there. The court addressed the case involved injuries arising from a, quote, workplace that is uniquely dangerous and not something that would routinely be encountered by anyone, which would.
But isn't there a difference between the third floor of a house under construction that has a hole in it that goes all the way to the basement, and a hospital environment where both patients and physicians and other staff are commonly walking around perfectly safely?
Our position is that proposition.
Where is the prima facie evidence of that?
Well, in Herndon, the employer said the claimant could have fallen down a hole in the second story of a house under construction for any number of reasons. And this court said the problem with this argument is it misconstrues the focus of our inquiry. The key focus is not the relationship between the injury and its cause, but rather the relationship between the injury and the employment. That is,
we said there is an actual risk of employment putting a worker on a three-story platform with a hole in the middle of it. That was an actual risk of the employment. I'm looking for the actual risk of employment here, and I'm having a hard time finding it.
Judge, I understand your argument, and our position is that, again, clothing and equipping a person as Mr. Rush was equipped here and placing him on a slippery latch floor is a uniquely dangerous situation that members of the public don't encounter every day. That's our position. Going back to the issue of whether or not the mentally unable to testify provision, again, it's noteworthy to us that the employer did not address Jones. Another noteworthy point is if the commission's view had prevailed in Jones, for example, if that reasoning applied there, the result would have been short and sweet. The court would have said, well, the witness is here, therefore he can't be unavailable. That is a strict interpretation of a statute that should be interpreted in a liberal way. And therefore, we say again that Jones supports our view, also the fact that when you look at that legislative judicial posture, the General Assembly was acting in an area where the courts had spoken before. Under the law, the General Assembly is assumed to know what the courts have said about matters the General Assembly is legislating on. And it obviously was trying to do something. And as the evidence or the judicial, progress of this statute up to the present, it's never been applied. There have been opportunities for it to be applied, but in each case, the decision has been it doesn't apply. Our position is this is the case. If it can't apply here, then the General Assembly did act in a futile manner. This case is, in our view, ready-made for this statute. I will hold the balance of my time. I want to conclude, though, my opening remarks by pointing out again the Workers' Comp Act is a remedial statute entitled to liberal construction. And from that, we believe that if principled reasons can be articulated to bring the facts of a given case within the coverage of the Workers' Comp Act, then that case should be included within the coverage of the Act. And we've articulated such reasons, principled reasons here. And I'll hold the balance of my time.
All right. Thank you, sir. Mr. Katz?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. The commission, may I please the court, this is Adam Katz representing the Commonwealth. The commission held in this case, correctly held in this case, that 65.2-105 does not apply. Specifically, they correctly held that the statute only applies where the claimant is physically or mentally unable to testify as confirmed by competent medical evidence. And that's the key here. There is no competent medical evidence at all that the claimant is unable to testify. In fact, he did show up and testify at the hearing coherently, but that's not the basis for the commission's opinion. The basis for the commission's opinion, in the way the statute reads, is there has to be competent medical evidence that he's unable to testify, and there is none here. He simply just doesn't remember how the accident occurred, and there's no indication from the plain and unambiguous language of the General Assembly that it intended the statute to apply under those circumstances. In fact, if this court agreed with the claimant, then it would be an end run around the well-established principle that unexplained accidents are not compensable. Again, there's no intention, there's no evidence that the General Assembly...
Let me stop you there. Unexplained accidents, I mean, Herndon does go to great lengths to significantly narrow cases like PYA Monarch, does it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's not just unexplained. It's where there is no evidence, circumstantial or otherwise.
Correct, Your Honor. And in Herndon, this court was able to infer how the accident occurred because, as you said, he was three stories up on a construction site and fell down a hole. Here, we have no idea at all how this accident occurred. The last thing Mr. Rush remembers when he came to work that day was walking towards the door to go in. He has no idea if he slipped, tripped, fell, got hit over the head. And he talks about the floors being slippery, but he admitted that he has no idea if the floors were slippery that day or if he slipped because of slick floors. He simply has no idea how the accident occurred, and the people who were deposed who investigated the situation were unable to determine how the accident occurred. We just simply have no idea how this happened. And as a result, there's no prima facie evidence that it's work-related. And two, you know, it doesn't arise. There's nothing to infer here. There's zero evidence to infer that the accident arose out of his employment or that it was work-related. And as far as Jones goes, I'll gladly address that here. That was an evidentiary ruling. Here we have a specific statute that was enacted by the General Assembly that has certain elements. One of those elements is that the employee has to be physically or mentally unable to testify as confirmed by competent medical evidence, and there's no medical evidence here. There also has to be prima facie evidence that it was work-related, and there's none of that here. Evidentiary rulings and a statute specifically enacted by the General Assembly are two different things. And this statute here is plain and unambiguous, and applying the facts to the law of facts to the statute, there's no prima facie evidence that this accident was work-related. And I think this court's recent opinion in Arroyo versus Ramirez, which was unpublished, should be highly persuasive here. This court found that the statute was plain and unambiguous and applied under the circumstances that we're arguing. And, you know, there's two elements to the statute. As I said, that there has to be mental or physical, the claimant has to be mentally or physically unable to testify as confirmed by competent medical evidence and prima facie evidence that it's work-related. And he can be neither of those. And as a result, the commission correctly denied this claim.
How is that Arroyo opinion, which is unpublished, consistent with Herndon? How do you account for one going one way and one kind of going the other?
Well, Your Honor, I think that in Herndon, there was, you know, all these cases are very factually sensitive, and they're close. But in this case, and I can't, you know, I'm not sure if I could. I think there was more evidence in Herndon than there was in Arroyo. But here there's no evidence at all to indicate that it's work-related. And I think the analysis in Arroyo under the presumption is what we have to focus on here. And Arroyo, you know, is a close case, but the analysis is the same, especially as far as the...
I mean, factually, this claimant suffered from a condition that the facts indicate pre-existed that has, you know, his fall that has nothing to do with his employment and that may well or is likely to be the source of the fall as opposed to slipping on a wax floor or anything else.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you.
I mean, so it's one thing when you have a fall. It's another thing when you have medical evidence that shows hydrocephalus or some other condition. And so, I think the commission looks at it and says, well, it could be the one thing, it could be something else. We just don't know.
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. He did have hydrocephalus, and that may have been the cause of the fall. That's further indication that there's no evidence that it's work-related. We have no idea. There could be, as Mr. Young said, there could be several explanations, but we just don't know in this case. And as a result, there's just nothing there to infer that the accident was work-related or arose out of the employment.
Let me ask you about the commission's opinion. The commission made the factual finding that there was no evidence that the injury arose from the actual risk of employment in the course of employment. Pardon?
No, I'm sorry. Could you clarify? Did you say in the arising out of the employment or in the course of?
Arising out of. And then they went on to discuss the issue of whether the claimant was able to testify. Having made that factual finding initially, do we even need to address whether he was able to testify or not? Because the statute requires both findings.
No, Your Honor. You're correct. It does require both findings. And either one, if there's no evidence, and there is credible evidence to support the commission's opinion that it was not work-related and did not arise out of the employment, based on that, this court could affirm the commission's opinion on that basis alone, and there would not necessarily be a need to address the testifying aspect of that. And I also wanted to add, I forgot to add that I think the commission chose the word testify, and I think that's important. That's a specific act, and there was no qualifiers or modifiers that they put on that when they read the statute. It says testify, and testify means testify. It seems that the claimant is just asking this court to add words to a plain and unambiguous statute enacted by the General Assembly.
All right, have you any other
questions?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just asking if there were any additional questions.
Oh, okay. Hearing none, it sounds like that's it. Thank you, Mr. Katz. Mr. Young, you have 4 minutes remaining.
Yes, sir. 3 points. Number one, the employer continues to hold the line, says there was no competent medical evidence that he was unable to testify. That can only mean that they're holding the line with regard to at the hearing. They've not addressed at all the issue of whether it should be also apply to about what. Our position is the statute sure can apply to at the hearing, but it also can mean mentally unable to testify about something. And that's the case here. We have competent evidence that Mr. Rush suffers from amnesia.
And this is Judge McCullough. I'm not asking you to concede anything about your argument, but the commission disagreed with you. If we disagreed with you, is that the end of the road for your argument? As I read your brief, the presumption is necessary for you to succeed, correct?
Yes, sir. I wasn't involved with this case early on. Frankly, that is the way it came up, that we're relying on one of the statute, the presumption
right.
of the statute.
Okay, I just want to make sure I'm not over-reading or under-reading the arguments presented. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Now, at pages 9 and 10 of our opening brief, we detailed the prima facie case, the elements that took this case, we contend takes this case out of the hazards that anyone else encounters each day, and we'll rely on that. And those uniquely dangerous conditions also would go to the idiopathic issue. Finally, the finding of the commission that there was no prima facie evidence, as we pointed out on page 9, this court has the power to review de novo the application of law to undisputed facts. There aren't any facts in disputes here. The only issue is the application of the law to them. And therefore, the review we contend is de novo on that issue of whether there's prima facie evidence. And I will stop here, and if you have any more questions, I'm available.
All right. Are there any questions? Nothing.
None from me. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. That sounds like there are no questions. And so thank you very much for your argument. The case is submitted.